Sounds True presents Your Buddha Nature, Part 9, The Perfection of Metta, Loving Kindness, with Jack Kornfield.
There are a lot of ways in which, when one speaks of the notion of the inner perfections, we look at ourselves and say, uh-oh, we need improvement. Things don't look terribly perfect. And it gets very confusing to think that spiritual practice in some way is to make our personality and our lives perfect through the right activities. There is a type of person for whom God is always mixed up with vitamins, let's say. Or as Alan Watts describes it, spirituality becomes a kind of grim duty in which one is trying to make yourself and everything else fit into some religious or spiritual ideal. The perfections that we speak of here are not how it is supposed to be, how it should be, but discovering something that is always true, that is eternally so. And so the perfection of the loving heart is a transcendent kind of joy and connectedness. The Dalai Lama, who is the quintessential expression of this in some ways, speaks about his happiness. He says, in the face of all the struggles and sufferings that people are asking him about and he needs to attend to, he said, what good is our spiritual life if it doesn't bring happiness to our heart in spite of everything in this world? So from the Bible, if I speak with the tongues of men and angels but have not love, I am become as sounding brass or a clanging gong. And if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. Love is patient and kind. It envies not, nor is it puffed up. Love seeks not its own good. It is not easily provoked, nor rejoices in misfortune of others, but rejoices in love itself. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Where there be knowledge or prophecy, it shall vanish, but true love shall not pass away. And when one begins the practices of the loving heart in the Buddhist tradition, often one begins with a reflection of the blessings of this quality of being, of love, loving heart, that comes as the heart opens or deepens in this capacity to rest in loving kindness. And so there's a text which lists 40 different benefits and blessings that come naturally to us. Our dreams become sweeter. We fall asleep easily and waken contented, and our health is better. And as the heart of loving kindness opens in us, angels love and protect us, and men and women will love us as well. And weapons won't harm us, poisons won't work, and so forth. And if you lose things, they will be returned to you, and you will have a beautiful rebirth. People will welcome you everywhere. And as the quality of loving kindness grows in us, our thoughts become pleasant. And animals will sense your kindness and love you. And elephants will bow slightly as you go by. It says it. Now you can try it at the zoo and see. I don't know. And your voice becomes sweeter and your babies are happy in the womb and as they grow up. And if you fall off a cliff, a tree will always be there to catch you. And your countenance becomes serene and the world becomes more peaceful around you. And you become recognized as the Buddha. In everyone that you meet, in yourself and others, you see the Buddha everywhere. Compassion and understanding spread from your heart to resonate with that same compassion in other beings wherever you go. So it's very wonderful the kind of blessings that come to us when we remember this quality of being. I had a wonderful teacher in India, in Calcutta. Her name was Deepa Ma, a great yogi and sage and saint, and a grandmother, and a tiny diminutive little person. She was probably, I remember when we would hug, and it was interesting because in India I thought, oh, this is this great saint, you know, you just kind of bow to her, and she came up and just threw her arms around me. You know, in Bengal they like to hug, it was great. I said, is this okay? She said, oh, we Bengalis like this, you know, wrapped her arms around, and my chin would kind of rest on the top of her head. So she was this tiny little grandmother who was a master of the practices of the heart, among many things. And she knew I was a teacher, and I had done some practice with her. I was a younger teacher then, visiting her, and she came to this country. And one day I had been in India for some time doing retreats and study and practice, some teaching, and I stopped in Calcutta to see her and give her a gift and get some blessings. I didn't have much time. And then I said, now I have to take a flight to Bangkok. And I was having quite a hard time at that point in my life. My personal life, having difficulties and traveling, and I'd been sick and just not in a very good state. And I said, I'm trying to work with it. And she said, oh, you need blessings. So she said, come here, give you this special blessing. First, this big hug. She just wrapped her arms around me and kind of knelt down then. And then she began to kind of just stroke my body, my head, my face, my shoulders, and as she did, she whispered softly these mantras or these sacred words of loving kindness, may you be peaceful and well, but the old ones in Sanskrit and Pali, over and over again, kind of stroking my body like with soft rain, again and again for a long, long time. First I was just standing there kind of just doing it and putting up with it in some way, you know, and then it just started to go in, you couldn't, and she kept doing it, and then she would blow on me, kind of to get it to go in, and did it some more. And she said, okay, you'll be fine now, go. And I got in my taxi, and it was a hot day in the hot season in Calcutta. It was like 3 hours through the Calcutta traffic to Dum Dum Airport. That's its name. It's really true. You know, and then through Indian customs, God, and then onto the airplane, and then to Bangkok, and out in the airport, and then through Thai customs, and then into Bangkok traffic, and to my hotel was like 9 or 10 hours, and it was sweltering hot and the traffic was terrible, and the entire time I was grinning like this, I could not stop, and I was just kind of in bliss, and I was grinning, and the customs people would say, where are you coming from? And I'd say, India. You know, where are you going? Thailand. And this, they kind of, again, I just had this kind of idiotic grin. I was so happy. I don't know what she did, but she had some serious mojo, really. And it was all the blessings of loving kindness. It's just wonderful. And you all know it. I mean, you know it in a moment when you meet it, when we meet it in one another. It's mysterious, this power, this quality that's love. And yet we all crave it. And we look for it in terms of appreciation, or in terms of being seen or acknowledged. But underneath it all, it is the love itself that draws us back to one another. Brian Swim, who is the kind of a teacher of the unfolding of the world with Matthew Fox's university and others, wonderful teacher, talks about it in the same language as gravity. He says one of the great universal forces everywhere is gravity, which means that things or experiences, whatever you want to call this earth, are drawn to one another. The moon and the earth and the sun and the galaxies, all this invisible yet ever-present force that pulls us back together. Instead of gravity, he calls it allurement, that everything is allured to each other. In some way, maybe it's this magnetic force is the memory when we were all together in the Big Bang, you know, and we miss it. And so we kind of pull back together. But it is really mysterious. We spend a lot of our life looking to love, to be loved, to discover what it is. What is it? Maybe it's just who we are. Maybe it's what we're made of. Maybe it is this very earth that makes our body. I remember going into an old chapel in Alte Etting in southern Germany. When my wife and I traveled there, we visit sometimes the places of the Black Madonna. Went to a number of such places. This was a little chapel with a kind of round ceiling. It was almost like adobe. Not very big. And you walked inside and the ceiling was painted dark, dark blue. Very dark blue. The whole chapel was kind of dark. And then on the ceiling, it was filled with these golden stars. It's like going into night. This dark blue ceiling and golden stars. And then in the front of the chapel was this black earth mother holding her child. And she had a golden crown on that just shone luminous light from her head and her crown and the being that held this child and the stars in the night. And it felt very old. It felt ancient. It felt like it had been there for thousands and thousands of years, that it had somehow come up out of the earth itself. It was really quite wonderful. And this is that force, that which makes the green plants grow in the spring as we get our rains, draws us together. So many ways to sense and know this love. Eskimos have 52 names for snow because it was so important to them. Wouldn't it be interesting to have more names for love? There are a lot of different kinds of love, if you will. There's the desire kind of love. I love ice cream. I love tennis, you know. I love good music and so forth. That kind of love, it's one kind. Love to have this or get that. There's businessman's love. Sometimes when I look at those ads, not all of them, but there are certain ones, you know, DWM, into this and that, seeking SW something or other for no commitments but some exchange of this and that, you know. You can see it in one's own relationship, in our relationship. Well, I'll do this for you if you'll do that for me. Do you know that businessman's love? Have you ever encountered that? That quality of love, but it's conditional. It's an exchange. There's the love of passion. Have to read a Neruda poem. I love Neruda. That's desire. That's the former kind. Your laughter. Take bread away from me if you wish. Take air away, but do not take from me your laughter. Do not take away the rose, the lance flower that you pluck, the water that suddenly bursts forth in your joy, the sudden wave of silver born in you. My struggle is harsh, and I come back with eyes tired at times from having seen the unchanging earth. But when your laughter enters, it rises to the sky, seeing me, and it opens for me all the doors of life. Next to the sea in the autumn, your laughter must raise in a foamy cascade, and in the spring, my love, I want your laughter like the flower I was waiting for, the blue flower, the rose of my echoing country. Laugh at the night, at the day, at the moon. Laugh at the twisted streets. Laugh at this clumsy boy who loves you. But when I open my eyes and close them, when my steps go, when my steps return, deny me bread, air, light, spring, but never your love and laughter, for without that I would die. There's a love poem for you. Oh, Pablo, thank you. But that's there in us too. You hear it and it resonates in this place. Like the love of a mother for a child. The love we can have for this life. Lama Tsongkhapa. This human body, at peace with itself, is more precious than the rarest gold or gem. cherish this body you have been given. It is yours this one time only, this human form one with difficulty and easy to lose. Worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky, like a tiny splash of raindrop. This thing of beauty, treasure the time you have been given with it. That kind of love. The love of all things. Do I love well? Have I loved well in this life? The great question. Kabir and Rumi, the mystics, who speak of it, love is a millstone that turns everything in the mill, or love, as Rumi says, with no door and no inside and no outside. What need for windows when there's no wall, says Rumi. Here we are together. The practice of loving kindness, one of the meditations in this tradition, was first taught by the Buddha to monks who were practicing in the forest, in caves in dark parts of the forest where there were wild animals and ghosts and strange sounds. And they came running back and said, "You told us to go and meditate in the forest, but this is a really dangerous place. What can we do? We are terrified and frightened." And he said, "Oh, I will teach you what will keep you safe, what will bring a fearlessness to your heart." Because in a way, the opposite of love is not hatred, but fear, isn't it? It's what closes the heart. He said, "I will teach you what brings a fearlessness." And he taught the practice of loving compassion for the trees and the animals and the earth and the ghosts, if there were any, of the forest. And they went back in and they listened, and each sound they heard, they offered their heart's love to. And it made it a very different forest indeed. The quality of love that we're talking about is that which can listen and sense without judgment, without demand, without wanting something different, without need. It's an openness to what is present. From Thomas Merton, he writes, "The rain I am in is not like the rain of the cities. It fills the woods with an immense, confused sound. It covers the roof of this cabin and its porch with insistent and controlled rhythms, and I listen, because it reminds me again and again that the whole world runs by rhythms I have not yet learned to recognize, rhythms that are not those of the engineer. Think of it, all that speech pouring down, selling nothing, judging nobody, drenching the thick mulch of dead leaves, soaking the trees, filling the gullies and crannies of the wood with water, washing out the places where men have stripped the hillside. What a thing it is to sit absolutely alone in the forest at night, cherished by this wonderful, unintelligent, perfectly innocent speech, the most comforting speech in the world. The talk that rain makes by itself over the ridges and watercourses and hollows. Nobody started it. Nobody is going to stop it. It will talk as long as it wants, the rain, and as long as it talks, I am going to listen." The sweetness in listening. Wavy Gravy, who is a wonderful, ridiculous, fine man, has done all kinds of amazing and strange things, has worked for a long time in his clown guise in the hospitals with the terminally ill and with children who are burn victims. He goes in, puts on his clown costume, you know, big wingtip shoes and green and red clown suit, and sometimes he'll go and just start with bubbles. He says, "I lead with the bubbles, and they know something's coming. It's not the doctor, right?" You know, and then I pull tricks out of my hat, and I play cards with them, and I hit the kids with riddles and stuff like that, you know, because things are really hard in there, in those places. I'll tell you a story. It was so hard for me seeing sick children. It was the hardest thing. Nobody teaches us how to do this. One day I was starting out making the rounds of this hospital in the Bay Area, Children's Hospital, and the shade was pulled down on this one room I couldn't see, so I went in there. They had these chrome crib beds for the worst of the burned children. And there was this one little black kid there. He was horribly burned. He looked like burnt toast. Pieces of his face weren't there. Pieces of his ears were missing. Where was his mouth? You could hardly tell who he was. It was just terrible, mind-boggling. You couldn't pin the face on the person. And my jaw dropped. I gasped. I came completely unglued. I didn't know what to do. You know, there I was, overwhelmed. What's going to happen to this child? And then all of a sudden, I'm trying to stay there, trying to get past the horror. Here we are, burnt toast and unglued clown, right? And this other little kid comes whizzing by. I think he was skating along with his IV pole. And he stops, kind of pushes around me, looks into the crib at this other kid and comes out with, "Hey, you ugly!" Just like that. And the burnt kid made this gurgling laugh kind of noise and his face moved around, and all of a sudden I just went for his eyes and we locked up right there and everything else just dissolved, like going through a tunnel to his heart, and we settled right in. And that was all. It's just that. Or Dorothy Day. One time a beggar woman with cancer of the face tried to kiss Dorothy Day's hand in the streets of New York. Dorothy commented, "Only thing I could do was kiss her dirty old face with the gaping hole in it where the nose had been." It sounds heroic, but it isn't. For what we avert our eyes from today can be born tomorrow when we learn a little more about the great power of love. Now sometimes, maybe a lot, when we hear the news or see homeless people on the streets or think about the environment or the endangered species or the kinds of problems that are faced in every continent, every part of our earth, we're afraid that it's too much, that the heart is not big enough to hold this. And yet the earth is the place to learn love. What else could it be? I like the practice of imagining that every being in the world is enlightened but one. You know who. Moi, as Miss Piggy would say, except for oneself. And they're all doing exactly the perfect thing necessary for you to awaken the great heart of loving compassion. The thing is that you can trust the heart. You can trust in your own bravery. You can trust in the possibility of awakening love because it's there in you and it's there in everyone. I read sometimes these offerings that are left at the temple of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Every week more things are left, and the Smithsonian has a whole huge building to keep the prayers and medals and teddy bears and letters that are left there. You know, one page of this book I have has a picture of the Congressional Medal of Honor that says on it, "Valor," with a letter that was left at the wall, "Dear President Reagan," from this man who writes, "Regretfully, Charles J. Litesky, former holder of the Congressional Medal of Honor." He wrote this during the time of the grave difficulties in Nicaragua and El Salvador and Guatemala. And he said, "I've seen enough of war. Dear President, I must return my medal, for it's not valorous to continue to fight there, and for you to say you are one of the Contras. I cannot keep myself in the same tradition as what you have said, so I return this to you regretfully." These kind of things people leave. Or notes. This note that's left. "Dear Alan, I didn't forget. It just took me a while. A long while. Finally, I called your parents. I couldn't find a way to say your son died saving my life. I know you'll understand. I finally did it, though. I talked to your father over the phone. It was difficult for both of us. But my load is so much lighter now. Johnny, Chips, Ted, Gerald, Bob, Jackson are all here with you. I miss you all. I miss you, brother. So much mercy offered. Never underestimate the power of the human heart, says Ram Dass. The power of just one person who is awake. When I look through that doorway, through the doorway of the heart, I see a power that makes the Pentagon seem like kids' toys. It is possible to love. It really is for each of us. Now, the ancient practice of loving-kindness meditation in the Buddhist tradition is this systematic cultivation, reminder to the heart, in which one begins by reciting the benefits of loving-kindness, being reminded that it is our true nature, and then often beginning past that with forgiveness to cleanse and clear the heart. We'll talk about that in a bit. And the idea in doing the loving-kindness meditation is to remind ourselves of what's beautiful and true in us, not to make a struggle or judge yourself or make it harsh. So you pick, in the beginning of this practice, one that opens the gate of your heart. Who would that be? Often it's a benefactor, a beloved person who saw you or honored you or helped you or gave something to you. And you begin with well-wishing to them, picture them, with the image and the feelings and simple phrases that are repeated over and over. May you be filled with loving kindness, this benefactor. May you be happy. May you have well-being of body, heart, and mind. May you be peaceful. Some people have trouble even thinking of a benefactor. I know one dear friend who used her teddy bear. See, it wasn't an animate object, but it was the same. Or somebody else who used their dog for metta. Well, that's the one. And it doesn't matter. Whatever image touches that place in us. And then you set the intention of the heart and you begin to recite it over and over. May you be well. May you be filled with loving kindness. May you be peaceful, happy. May you have well-being of body, heart, and mind. And as you do it for this beloved one, this benefactor, over and over and over, thousands of times, all the hindrances come up. Me? I should love that much. I'm not the right person to do this, to love this other person. Or maybe we're doing loving kindness meditation and we do it for ourselves in this way. I don't deserve it. You know, or I don't have it in me to bless another. And our shame comes and our guilt and our grief. And we do it some more. We get restless or bored. Or this isn't working. We have doubt. Or we get angry and all the frustration and pain in our life comes up. And in this practice, you simply keep saying it with the intention of the heart in the midst of the anger or doubt or frustration or shame. May you be well anyway. May you be filled with loving kindness. May you be held in the heart of peace, compassion. And the intention of the heart, through all the waves of difficulty and happiness and pain and joy and guilt and shame and possibility, all those things come up. And you just keep saying it over and over and over, wishing well, until something happens. It cracks something open. It melts something open. And joy, rapture, the genuineness of loving kindness grows. It does. The heart's amazing. You just remind it. It's like planting seeds. And all of a sudden, whoosh, the whole field gets filled with grass and flowers. May you be well. Or you do it for yourself. That's a hard one, huh? I don't deserve it. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be peaceful. Who, me? May I have well-being, body, heart, mind. Over and over and over. Until you just can almost sing it. And you just do it and do it and do it. Ah, so sweet. And then the practice is expanded. When you can do that and you feel this great love for the benefactor that you have, the beloved one, you feel it for yourself, then you work with a neutral person. Neutral person, what's that? Somebody that you don't know, that you see around, who you don't have much feeling for either way. And you start to look around, because there's a lot of neutral people. And then you pick them and you start extending to that beloved one those same phrases now to this person you don't know. May you be well. May your heart be filled with loving kindness. Have well-being of body, of heart, of mind. You do it over and over and over again. I did it for a cook on one retreat. I was doing this loving kindness meditation retreat. Person who was cooking, who lived at that place. I didn't even know them. This person I'd seen cooking. And after a while, start to discover this great category. Start to see all these other neutral people that I... And then I would see the cook and I would go, oh, I love you. You know, I didn't know who they were. I knew nothing about them. But they had become the subject of my loving kindness meditation. They were my new romance. You know, and I'd be walking through the halls and going by the kitchen and there would be that person who I was sitting in meditation sending these loving intentions to. And I would see them and say, oh, my favorite, oh. You know, I would almost swoon when I saw them, you know. Can you understand that? And then all of a sudden you do it for another and another. Pretty soon the world becomes peopled with all these beings that you love and they don't even know it. When Mother Teresa went to San Quentin to visit the people inside, those human beings who are in there, like us being in here, before she left, she said, I have something important to ask of you. And she asked them to pray for her. She asked them to pray for her. You usually think of it the other way around, don't you? But she said, no, please pray for me because I need it. Because we're all the same, really. And because it's in loving another that we feel loved, isn't it? If they could pray for her, they could begin to pray for themselves. From Pablo Casals, he writes, the answer to helplessness is not so very complicated. A person can do something for peace without having to jump into politics. Each one of us has inside a basic and fundamental goodness and decency. If we listen to it and act on it, we are giving a great deal of what the world needs most. It's not complicated, but it takes courage. It takes the courage for a person to listen to their own good heart and act on it. Do we dare be ourselves? This is the question that matters. So she asked them to pray for her. And then, as this practice goes further, you do the neutral people for a while and you extend that to all the neutral beings. You come back to yourself and your benefactor more, your beloved ones. And then you go to your enemies, the people who've wronged you. Like the Dalai Lama says, my friend's the enemy, you know. And there you are in bliss and you love the cook and you love this and you love the gardener and everybody around. And then you think of that person who did it and your heart goes like that and shrivels and shrinks and they did it and you're angry. And all of a sudden you feel how incredibly painful it is to have your heart closed. Not for them. I mean, there they are, you know, they're in Hawaii on vacation, right? Who's suffering? It's me. And you say, I can't stand it. And so you begin to say, may you be well. Because you can't put anybody out of your heart. You understand that. And there comes this unstoppable sweetness and well-being. Believe me, unstoppable. My dear friend Gosananda, who is the Gandhi of Cambodia, with whom I worked in the Cambodian refugee camps. He leads this peace march through the most troubled war zones of Cambodia every year now. More and more thousands of people walk with him. And he says, we just pray with each step for peace and offer our prayers to each person we come across in the mountains, and the soldiers, we bow to everyone. impartially, like the rain that falls upon the just and the unjust. We offer this peace. The acts of love that fail are just as much a part of the divine love as that act of love which succeeds. We just offer it with our intention. It's the direction of the heart again and again. And so he becomes the light of Cambodia. Everybody looks at him in that country and they see their own love as he walks through the mountains, kind of a benefactor. And out of that, we see that love and forgiveness come together. The ground of forgiveness, of letting go of the pains of the past. Because we have each been betrayed or abandoned or hurt. Everyone has. You know the story, the World War II prisoners of war, I guess it was, who finally met up many years later, and one said to the other, "Have you forgiven your captors yet?" And the second said, "No, never." And the first one said, "Well, then they still have you in prison, don't they?" The forgiveness is, again, not for anyone else. It's for us. The love of the heart, in the end, is not for anyone else. It's for us. Of course, us gets bigger and bigger. It's nice. That's for all of us. And forgiveness doesn't mean we condone the things that cause pain to others. We may say, "Never again. I will put my own body in the way of allowing this pain to happen to another. I will not let it happen." It is simply the knowing inside that we will not put another living being out of our heart. And it becomes contagious. Because without forgiveness and letting go, we have the Bosnians and the Serbs and the Croats and the Hutus and the Tutsis, you know, and the Sunnis and the Shiites. Or we have the tribalism and the racism in our own cities and the clans and the nations and the Hatfields and the McCoys. And we have it in our own families. You all know it. Without forgiveness, this power of love cannot open. It's a tremendous courage if you want to see the brave, says the Bhagavad Gita. Look to those who can forgive. If you want to see the heroic, look to those who can return love in the face of anger, hatred. And it's contagious. It's really wonderful. Martin Luther King talked so much about it. He said, "Never succumb to the temptation of becoming bitter. Never. For if you succumb to that temptation of using violence in the struggle, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness. Don't do it. As you press for justice, be sure to move with dignity and discipline, using only the instrument of love, the instrument of your heart." I read a story, I was told a story, sometime recently, about Ishi. Do you remember who Ishi was? The book Ishi in Two Worlds? Ishi was the last member of his particular Indian tribe, Native American tribe, from Southern California, to still speak his language and to still be alive. And he was taken in by the Krogers, the anthropologist at Berkeley, if I remember correctly. He became their friend and informant and described all of his tribe's life and customs and really taught them. And they cared for him and protected him in some ways. And at the end of Ishi's life, when he was near to dying, he said, "I've taught you most everything about my tribe, but one thing which I could not teach, I was sworn never to speak or tell anyone outside of our village, outside of our community. This is the most important song of our whole tribe. for it is the song that takes us when we die back to our tribe, to all those ancestors who are waiting for us, who have gone before us. And we're never allowed to teach it to someone outside our tribe and village. It can only be sung to those in the tribe so that we will all meet again together. And then he looked at them and he said, but I am the last of my tribe. And so though, even though I have promised, I've been sworn to never teach this song to anyone else, I must teach it to you once, to one person outside. And remember, this was the race. These were the people that had decimated the entire tribe. I will teach you this last song, and then you can sing it to me when I die and sing me back to my people. There's an enormous grace in forgiveness, and a wonderful power that is our own true nature, the compassionate heart, in every single being. It is that song, like the song of Ishi, that can take us back to what really matters. And if you look at all of our life, what is it that really matters in the end, but that we are loved and can love? Let's sit for a moment. Allow your eyes to close gently. Breathe gently in the area of the heart. See if you could breathe in and out of the chest or the heart softly. And sit with the great heart of a Buddha. As you breathe, feel your own body and life, and the capacity to cherish it and wish yourself well. May I be filled with loving kindness, with each breath. May I have well-being of body, of heart, of mind. The intention of the heart. May I be peaceful and happy. Offering yourself the kindness that we've withheld for so long. Be aware of the measure of sorrows you've been given in this life. Each of us has a certain measure of pain or suffering that we must bear. Feel a compassion for it. And yourself. The image from the Buddha is like a mother holding her most beloved child. Can you hold your sorrows in great compassion with each breath of kindness? Feel, if you can, the places where you have withheld your love to yourself, to others. Is it worth it? Is it worth it? Let your heart soften with each breath. The heart of infinite compassion for every single being, near and far. It's not far away what we seek. It is our own true nature. May I be filled with love and compassion. May I know the love of my own heart deeply. Imagine that you are the Buddha. Pretend for a little bit. Sit and radiate kindness toward all beings around you. One of the great practices of the heart is to pretend you're enlightened and act as if it were so. And then someday you won't be able to tell the difference.
This concludes part 9 of Your Buddha Nature with Jack Kornfield. Please turn the tape over for part 10.